Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurink. A little later, we have State Representative John Hoadley joining us, and Mike Malott will be with me for that one. But first, joining us in studio is the Grassroots Midwest team, Adrian Hemond and Brian Began. Thanks, guys, for coming over. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Thanks.
All right, well, let's talk about the big decision from the week. The U.S. Supreme Court has decided that we are not going to have any type of change in terms of how we view political gerrymandering. The High Court is saying we don't want anything to do with this. And so basically, all these suits that we're seeing across the country are pretty much dead. I wanted to get your guys' opinion on what this means for Michigan. Adrian, sure. I'll start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first thing to take away from this is, as you say, most redistricting lawsuits are DOA now. The exception to that is the recent decision about the Virginia maps, which court held was a racial gerrymander. So there's a difference here if you can prove that a protected class is being targeted. But as the Chief Justice pointed out in his opinion, it's kind of a leap to put a political party down as a protected class.
Why is that, Brian? What makes the political party sacrosanct as far as the courts are concerned?
Well, it's not necessarily that it's sacred. It's just that where do people live? It's like, how am I going to make that standard? You get to Detroit, like 98% of the people there vote Democrat. Well, is that gerrymandering when someone draws a district of it? No. So, and I think that's kind of where it gets to it, is like, we don't really have control over where people live. So on why they're saying that, oh, you're giving yourself an unfair advantage. No, that's just where people live. So, and I think they're taking that into consideration, because if you were to get into really extremes, yeah, you'd have districts zigzagging, but you don't. So
I think the other thing that the Chief Justice rightly pointed out in his opinion is that the court's going to be really reluctant to get involved in another branch of government policing itself, particularly when, you know, it's spelled out in the Constitution that they get to do so, and that, you know, the states get to decide how they're going to draw their districts. You know, number one, there are other avenues of redress. And, you know, the Chief Justice pointed that out in his opinion. Michigan's a great example of that, right? Why does the court need to get involved when the citizens, if they're unhappy with the way the districts are being drawn, they have redress. They can go to the ballot and they can force another way of drawing those districts. So I think that that's a really important point. The other thing is, you know, the Chief Justice acknowledged in his opinion that the district drawing process in these cases was nakedly political, but that doesn't mean that that's a reason for the court to intervene if there's another way to achieve redress. And there are multiple ways. You know, we could amend the Constitution. Congress could pass laws around this. Certainly state legislatures are empowered to pass laws around this. And then there's the ballot initiative process. And so the court's always going to be reticent to jump in front of that train unless there's literally no other redress. You know, so I think that that's a really important point to keep in mind here, too, is that, you know, you don't have to sue. You don't have to come to us. Pass a ballot initiative. Lobby your state legislature.
The thing that was fascinating, I think, about this decision for me, when you combine it with the census question, was the fact that the Chief Justice was the deciding, he was the only member of the court in both majority opinions, which really kind of demonstrates the pivot role that he's now playing. When you think about when he was appointed, I think a lot of people considered him to be a looming arch conservative. Clearly, he's kind of the moderate wing of the Republican appointees on that court. So I thought that was kind of fascinating to watch.
How bummed you got to be if you're the House Democrats right now or the Senate Democrats? You were hoping, hey, maybe we can get some different looking maps. Maybe we got a better shot at majority. And now, not so much, Brian.
Actually, I believe privately they're breathing a sigh of relief.
Do you really?
Yeah, because if, like, they changed the Senate maps, you'd have a lot of people that would be up for re-election in a lot of new districts that they might not be prepared to. Just because of the targeted districts, you would have saw 2/3 of the map change. Or we would have had run into the term limits questions. Now they don't got to worry about that. They can just worry about serving out the rest of 2 terms, being termed at that time. Life is easy. Same thing on the House. You don't know what you get, because particularly in Detroit, the way, you know, how narrow it is, they could get new districts. So they're going to talk tough because, yeah, they're going to say, ooh, the Republicans drew these maps awfully. but you're not necessarily going to like what you get. So yeah. I think they're making that assumption. So I think privately there's a lot that are going, woo.
Yeah. I think the other thing to keep in mind about this is, and John sort of danced up to this point about the role the Chief Justice plays on this court. The Chief Justice is an institutionalist. Pure and simple. He's quite conservative, but he also cares a lot about the legitimacy of the court, and he does care a lot about, you know, things like separation of powers issues. If you are one of those legislative Democrats who actually thought that this Supreme Court was going to force new maps to be drawn before 2020, you got taken in by grifters.
If this decision does hold, and we're assuming it does, that no redistricting happens in the next 2 years here in Michigan, the real winners here, I think, are state voters and state taxpayers.
Why is that?
Because we already decided this last year. And I think it would be the height of hubris for any court, whether it be a federal court or a state court, to come in and say, yay, Michigan, even though you put in voters, not politicians, you reform the entire redistricting process, we're going to pull the rug out for the next 2 years. We're going to force you to spend all this money. We're going to throw all the political actors up in the air. Absolutely. And cause all sorts of chaos. I just think that's the height of hubris.
I do think it's interesting the different arguments that have been playing out in these particular redistricting cases and the amount of math and technical expertise that has gone into what the different maps could look like and what kind of advantages Republicans and Democrats would have in various scenarios, and how there's like almost a bell curve of what maps could look like and how they are beneficial to one party, they're not beneficial to the other, and how that math played a role in the arguments that were before the Supreme Court. And like, this is a way you can look at it, and there are maps that show that in a vast majority of the cases, they can be made so that they are more even partisan-wise. And then there are some that are so far off the edge that it's clear that it's partisanship. You would think, and let me bounce this off you guys, because since you can now prove this through actual numbers and math, wouldn't it be good for the court to say, hey, since we have standards for disadvantaged populations, African-American populations, for example, what's wrong with saying that a particular class of people, in this case Democrats, are getting written off in some of these maps?
Well, I think number one, when you talk about racial gerrymanders, like what we saw in the Virginia case, you know, we're talking about innate characteristics of people. I'm a Democrat. I was not born a Democrat. I just happened to be a Democrat. So it's a little difficult to see how that would be a protected class in the same way as being born African-American, which I also was. You know, these two things are qualitatively different from one another. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. The other thing is that partisanship is not the only factor that matters in how you draw district maps. Brian alluded to this earlier. If you live in the city of Detroit, you're going to be represented by a Democrat. Huge majorities of the people that live in the city of Detroit vote for Democrats. If you value more competitive districts, I can tell you exactly how you do that. You draw the city of Detroit like a sunburst that reaches out into places like Algonac, that reaches up into maybe even into Lapeer County, depending on how thin you draw the sunburst. We can make the state a lot more competitive. Obviously, you know, things like the two majority minority districts that we're required to have here make that a lot more difficult in terms of competitiveness, because Wayne County is the most Democratic area of the state. Detroit is the most Democratic city in the state, and that happens to be where a large number of African-American voters live. And unless you're trying to invoke like busing, like desegregation, I'm not sure how you fix that other than drawing the city like a sunburst, which obviously creates the whole problem with preserving majority-minority districts. And it's important to remember, part of the reason that these districts look so weird in a lot of instances, which people complain about all the time, is exactly because of those majority-minority districts, right? There are, what, about 600,000 people in the city of Detroit, and not all of them are African-American, obviously. You need 750,000 people for a congressional district, and you're allowed zero deviation. So how do you draw those two majority-minority districts? You reach up into Southfield. You reach up into Pontiac. There's no other way to do it.
Well, and that's what I want to ask you about, Brian, because let's presume that Michigan does lose a congressional district in 2022. We're down to 13. How do you preserve those two majority-minority districts with only 13 congressional districts? It was hard enough to do the 14. As Adrian said, they ended up looking like snakes. They're being charmed.
Well, yeah, and that's sort of a big question going into it that I've spent some time thinking about, because as the city of Detroit goes, you know, population goes down, and now you have a more diverse crowd also moving into the city, So you don't have the same concentration you do of like a particular ethnic group the way you did like in the 1960s. Since then, you've had a lot of people from the Detroit area move into Southfield, into Farmington Hills, into Redford, et cetera, et cetera. So you don't really have that dense concentration. So you're finding those people. Now, and this is where you start running into the legal issue, because where's the next big cluster of African Americans? Oh yeah, Flint. So are you going to run up 75 to pick up Flint Mount Morris and have an even more stranger map to meet this federal requirement? Because you just don't have those dense clusters. So without seeing the population of the area, of what you're going to get, or you're going to see a lot of burst into certain cities, like maybe the southern part of Warren grabs down here, here, here. So you just get a lot more odd shapes, because it's just become more challenging in the last like 50, 60 years.
So we could see a congressional district then that stretches from Detroit all the way to Flint along I-75, because that's the only way you can get a majority-minority district.
That's what I'm assuming right now. It's kind of like with the North Carolina case like 20 years ago, which was a little bit more egregious, where they ran up like a highway to kind of link the two areas. That would be my guess, is what they'd have to do is to loop into Flint, because can you think of any other large cluster of African Americans?
Not big enough to make two majority-minority districts, and presuming that we still have to have two, which I think is potentially a subject for litigation before the next redistricting occurs, if you have to have two, it's hard to see how you don't end up running up I-75.
And you're going to run into the same issues with your House and Senate maps, too, because you have to have 5 in the Senate and 12 in the House. So, you know, your Wayne County, where you might see certain growth on the Democratic voting, yeah, you're going to see a lot. You might see parts of Detroit get into Livonia, too, to meet those numbers. It's why, like, the points are split now.
It's a kind of a great demonstration, too, about this concept of communities of interest. I mean, because if you're Flint, I would assume that the majority of the focus is going to be, and the votes are going to come out of the city of Detroit, your community in Flint's not really going to get that much face time or representation or interest from that congressional member.
Absolutely. It's a very interesting thing how these came about and how this plays into both the partisanship and the local representation, right? We have this requirement for the two majority-minority districts because of both de facto and de jure segregation in housing, redlining, things like that, where, you know, for a long period of time, you know, the first couple black families move in and everybody runs away to get their kids out of those schools. That's not to say that that doesn't continue to happen, because it absolutely does, but it's not enforced by law anymore. And that's actually, ironically, for populations of folks, African Americans like myself, that largely vote Democratic, it's actually decreased their political power on a partisan basis by requiring these majority-minority districts. What you end up doing is packing a group into largely Democratic voters into districts that Republicans can't win. And what that means is there are fewer Democratic voters to go around to make districts more competitive.
And it makes me wonder then, who's going to try and ask the court and say, you know what, can we cut the number of majority-minority districts from 2 to 1? I mean, who makes that request? Is that the new redistricting commission? Does Jocelyn Benson?
Nobody wants to.
Yeah.
I mean, because that sounds like a political landline. It's as if the NAACP isn't the one who asks for it to their advantage, who's going to want to bite the bullet and do that?
It's kind of a hot potato. I expect that someone will end up filing a lawsuit. I expect it will be very, very opaque who is actually paying for that lawsuit, because I don't think anybody actually wants to take credit for that, but I expect it to happen.
Last thing I wanted to ask you guys before I let you go on your way here, the 3rd Congressional District, Lynn Afendoulis threw her hat into the ring. It looks like we have a Fred Meyer grandson who's going to get into the race as well. Not getting too deep into the primary, let's talk about, can the Democrats win this district? And Brian, I know you've looked at numbers. Can a Democrat win this district? And what kind of Democrat can win this district?
I think a Democrat could win, just because you look at the way Kent County is. Trump barely won the district, well, Kent County like 4 years ago, with less than 50% of the vote. And we've seen, just looking at the city of Grand Rapids and how far to the left it's gone, it's just become extremely more Democrat. Same thing with Kentwood. You get to Wyoming. Areas like that have become increasingly Dem. And so you see there's like a marginal base. And now what we have like on the Republican side is a referendum on Trump. Amash wins in a crowded primary, well, you have a lot of Republicans that will probably stay home and not vote for him. They'll say, yeah, let's let him lose and we'll vote for a real Republican next time.
Right.
Or you get someone that's pretty much Donald Trump, you know, the third, I guess, Jim, you know, which would be Jim Lauer, who's the one taking the very Trump position. And then you might have some more moderates turned off or the Amash people turned off. So it's a very complicated primary right now, so you might risk losing someone of your coalition. And also, the Democrats that I've seen getting in look pretty legitimate. So, and depending on how well or how bad the president does, I think Democrats have the possibility of winning it. Not saying they will, but the possibility is there.
All right, let's do percentages. Do they have a 20% chance of winning?
I'd say, I guess I'll be generous and say 33%.
Ooh, 33. Would you go that far, Adrian?
I would not. Honestly, this is going to be a fun reversal where Brian thinks that the Democrats have a much better chance here than your friend the Democrat does. I think they have virtually no chance here.
And even with DCCC help?
You know, the DCCC isn't getting the candidate that they wanted here. They wanted Winnie Brinks, and they're not getting her. Winnie might have had a chance against the right Republican here. But so far, the right Republican for Winnie Brinks to beat, in my opinion, has not gotten into this race. I don't think Winnie could beat Lynn Afendoulis in this race. I don't think she could beat Justin Amash. Maybe she could beat Lauer, but I'm pretty skeptical of that as well. To Brian's point, this district is trending that way, but it's not there yet. And, you know, you'd have to have a pretty far right Republican in this race who had some baggage that you could really beat him or her up about in order for a Democrat to take this time with the president on the ballot. The president's partisans are coming out this time. Even if it's Amash, I think Amash gets most of those voters because of what the alternative is going to be. I mean, you think Justin Amash doesn't like the president, wait till you get a Democrat.
That's a very good point. You guys think that Amash is running, right?
Absolutely, I think he's running.
All right, he's not running for president, Brian?
We'll see. No one understands the whole presidential race because here we are three years ago, we were all like, oh, Donald Trump, he has no chance in hell. There is no way this guy can win the primary. Well, now he's president, and the Democrats have whatever they have on their primary side right now.
A clown car.
Yeah, so there are just so many, you know, balloons up in the air that it's really tough to predict a year and a half out. You know, we can have this conversation a year, and it'll be like, okay, well, this is kind of materialized or haven't materialized, so.
Yeah, I don't see Amash running for president, but I think if he does, he hurts the president pretty bad.
Also, I think Republicans really come home if we run into the whole Supreme Court vacancy again, because nothing fires up conservatives like the court stuff.
Absolutely.
So if you have a retirement or something, yeah, we got to rally.
Brian Biegun, Adrian Heeman, thanks for joining us on this edition of the podcast. And let's take a quick break and we'll go join John Hoadley. Join us here in MERS World Headquarters is State Representative John Hoadley, Democrat from Kalamazoo, and also 6th Congressional District candidate. Thanks for making the journey over here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about the budget first of all, because that seems to be what's consuming everyone's attention. What are some doable things that you think that you can do on the budget to make improvements that can ultimately get signed into law?
So the first thing is that we have to actually fix the roads. And I think what we're seeing right now is a conversation where folks are bringing supplemental or additional ideas to the table. But the governor really framed the debate in a smart way, which is we have to have $2.5 billion of road funding dedicated to the roads. And we have to hit that so we can actually fix the roads. You know, and if we want to talk about slightly different ways to get there or how we're going to do that, that's all can be on the table as long as it hits the real mark. And frankly, shouldn't be done so in a way that jeopardizes other priorities of our state, like giving our children a quality education, cleaning up the drinking water in a lot of places. You know, I think that is the underlying issue that we all know is the biggest pothole in this process. That said, I also think there's been, from our side on the House at least, we've been able to work generally pretty well with our Republican colleagues, making sure that there's a mix of priorities in the budgets. As long as we got past this idea that we can do lazy across-the-board cuts to IT and admin, which, you know, after 8 years of Republican control, now all of a sudden there's, in theory, fat in those budgets where they look to not trim for the last 8 years. I mean, come on.
But are there cuts that can be made to the budget?
Sure. And, you know, I think even the governor talked about reprioritizing, you know, significant cuts within budgets to move things around. Yes, we can absolutely, though, I think, get stuff done. And we've demonstrated that we're able to do that. If we get past this conversation, though, about these across-the-board cuts, which is really just a hidden cut to programs, and we can get to some real conversation around the money to fix the roads, you know, we're almost there then. And I hope that folks see that, because
there's a lot of waste in IT, though. I mean, you would concede that there is a lot of waste within, let's say, the programs with the Department of Health and Human Services. And there's been problems in the implementation with the Secretary of State's IT programs. Doesn't that send a signal to those departments that, hey, you guys got to shape this up because we're seeing money go flying out the window?
We're looking at contracts that were entered into under the Republican administration that have not produced the results that they're supposed to. So to have my Republican colleagues now say, well, look at all this waste, you know, they should have been looking 1, 2, 3, 4, I can keep going, years ago. You know, and then to now, though, to call it waste, when we know, though, that there are still important services that have to be done. Because we've had problems with the MySAC list program in DHHS, because Republicans have made costly change orders to key services because of Medicaid work requirements or because of court orders coming out and showing that we weren't staffing foster care, because of all of that, to now say, well, we should just cut the IT is really obscuring the fact that we still have to make sure that kids are protected who are in foster care, that we actually are delivering services that we're going to promise. These across-the-board cuts, I think those are lazy. Now, I give a lot of credit to Director Gordon coming in, you know, picking up the phone, trying to renegotiate some of these contracts. Frankly, the IT work that's happening now is a work group that Chairman Hernandez put out, bipartisan way. I'm excited. We should definitely have those conversations. But it's not wasteful. Those are some bad contracts and some bad work. Let's get that better. But we also still have to meet the contract obligations that Republicans signed in previous years.
So you just dropped a bill calling for tolls on commercial trucks on bridges. Explain what you're trying to accomplish.
So Rhode Island instituted a program that charged trucks that were going over bridges a toll. So then, and then used those funds to help fix up those bridges. The bridges across the state of Michigan are in bad shape. And some of them, you know, are bridges that our children are driving over every day, that, you know, in school buses that we take to go to work. And we've seen the result of a bridge collapse. I mean, actually, you know, when we talk about bridge collapses, we're all talking about Minnesota, mm-hmm. and we're all talking about Minneapolis. My sister and my brother-in-law lived there. My brother-in-law drove over that bridge that day. My sister drove over the day before. So, yeah, I want to fix the bridges. We want to fix the bridges. And frankly, you know, we know that heavy trucks end up doing more damage to our roads. So this Rhode Island style tolling says we're actually just charging a toll for going over those bridges. It would be done in a way without toll, you know, plazas or anything like that. It's the free tolling space, right? So no one's going to slow down. It's targeted to trucks. There are reasonable limits in the bill for how much a truck can be charged every day. Can't exceed $40. It's $10 per way. I mean, like, there's some reasonable limits, but it would generate perhaps $50 million a year that could then be going towards fixing bridges, which, as we get to a final plan around roads, having some dedicated funding to help fix those bridges would be really important.
So then, is this like the fast pass? Okay, so you don't have to stop at a toll booth. It electronically picks up that your truck is crossing that.
That's right.
Okay, and then is this all bridges or some bridges?
You have to select the bridges and where they're going to be. And the goal is to dedicate the revenue to go and fixing those bridges, which then we can cost shift where some of the other money is in and where other bridge maintenance money is used in the state. We give some flexibility in this, but ultimately we are underfunding our bridges, and this starts putting some money back on the board and asking those trucks that are doing some of the most damage to actually pay their fair share and part of this conversation.
Have you gotten any response yet from the trucking industry on this?
Not yet. I guess my CB has been a little quiet. But, you know, this is one of those pieces where this is a reasonable expense. So many folks have been asked to dig so deep on the personal side for how many years, whether that was the Snyder birthday tax increase on registration fees or, you know, the way that some of the gas tax implements increases have been done in the past. People want to see, and I can empathize, that the trucks, you know, step up here too, and that they're paying a fair share. And so I think this is a really smart way to do it. And those trucks need good bridges just as much as the rest of us.
Another idea that's floating around is postponing or spreading out over time our pension liabilities as relates to employees, maybe possibly school employees, and spreading out those payments over longer periods of time and freeing up some cash. What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm willing to look at any good idea that folks have about solving our budget, but doesn't it seem like a little bit of an accounting gimmick to say, like, that's going to solve our problem, to just space out what we owe over a longer period of time? And, you know, and maybe, you know, someone can make an argument for it. I'm open to hearing it. But it doesn't change the fact that we have made a promise. People have earned these pensions. We need to pay this money. And I'm tired of folks saying, like, well, you know, we can sort of rob Peter to pay Paul today so we can make sure that they get something tomorrow. Maybe future will pay. Yeah, we're enough, right? I am 35 years old. I have been watching these conversations my entire life. You know, I learned that if we want nice things, that we've got to pay for them. If we make a promise, we should keep it. And I mean, our teachers, I mean, that's who's going to be the most impacted by these types of conversations. They work their lives to try to invest in, you know, someone else's kids usually. And now we're saying, well, hey, maybe we're going to gamble with your retirement. Come on, let's take care of this. You know, I am open. It could be maybe part of a larger conversation that helps us achieve some of these goals, but I don't think accounting gimmicks are going to save the day.
Let's move on then from state government to federal government. With all these problems at the state level, why do you want to go to the federal government?
You know, I'm really excited that I have legislative experience under my belt. I think it's taught me a lot. How to work with people you don't always agree with, how to find compromise, but also how to make sure you keep fighting for your values and moving those conversations forward. We need to see more of that at the federal level. I'm ready to lift my hand up and offer some ideas on how to solve some big problems. Whenever I'm looking at legislation or votes here in the legislature, I've always been thinking about, how do you put people in community at the center of our decisions? It's something I hear from a lot of my neighbors, you know, my friends. It's a shift in thinking about how we solve problems. There's been a whole lot of choices made over the last 10, 20, 30 years that have not set us up for success today and tomorrow. You know, I think there's a whole generation of folks who are saying, let's rise to those challenges. Let's actually solve those challenges. And I want to be part of that. I'm excited. I'm running. It's been great being all over the district. We started with a listening tour. We did 15 cities in the month of April. You know, we've been, you know, working with stakeholders and community members ever since. It's going really well. And I'm hoping that we can bring some positive change to D.C.
So on your listening tour, what's the issue that you heard that surprised you the most?
There's three things that came up a lot. One is sort of a general conversation around healthcare, and I get that. You know, we need to make sure it's affordable and accessible for everybody. I also heard a ton on the environment, making sure that we're protecting our environment, our Great Lakes, our drinking water. All those sort of came up. But the one that surprised me in how consistently it was brought up was affordable housing. You know, big cities, small cities, rural, urban, everywhere of the 13 of the 15 places that I went and talked to, someone organically brought it up. There is a different type of housing bubble that we're on, which is the fact that too many homes are becoming too unaffordable for too many people. And it looks slightly different in a lot of communities, but we got to figure that out because, you know, we want people to have a place to call home. Kids do better, communities do better. Don't want to have people where the vast majority of their paycheck just goes to having to pay the rent or paying the mortgage.
I was just listening to a piece, I believe it was on NPR, about this the other day. And what they were indicating was that while plenty of apartments are being built and plenty of the bigger, more expensive homes are being built, what's lacking in the market is new construction of affordable, smaller, less expensive houses. But that's not going to happen unless business can make a profit doing it. How do you incentivize that from the federal level?
Well, I think we need to be doing a couple of things. First is that we need to make sure that when it comes to housing policy, that we are trying to alleviate from a lot of different perspectives the squeeze that a lot of first-time home buyers are getting. And these are, what I'm talking about, are regular folks who are coming out of college with too much student debt. They're getting married and they're starting jobs where those jobs don't pay enough and historically have not kept up with what generations before 30 years ago were making. And then on top of that, we're seeing housing stock that has been depleted over time, right? Or some of those smaller homes that might be great for a place where you're starting out, you know, are becoming either bought up and they were torn down and rebuilt with the McMansions or right, they weren't properly maintained, and now that stock isn't a great place where you want to have a kid. So, like, we're watching this story of that specific moment in people's lives, first job, first kid, first marriage, hopefully only one, all getting stuck, right? First student loan payment, and then not being able to afford a place. So they're either staying in an apartment, they can't afford to make the big jump to the big homes. So I think there's a lot we can do, though. Largely, I hope we ultimately raise wages for folks so more working people are taking home more money. From a housing standpoint, by encouraging, we can help on one side with the skills piece by training more folks, getting more people into those jobs in construction, supporting the skilled trades. You know, it's going to make it easier for those companies that are hungry and scrappy and they want to start building houses and get into the development game to have a workforce that's ready to work and will then take on some of these projects that maybe don't have as big of a profit margin that, you know, and a more experienced company might require before they jump in. This is part of a federal policy playbook that could happen where we actually are trying to turbocharge the sector. And so that could happen in a lot of different ways, from bonding to capital supports to better loans for those small entrepreneurs. Lots of things we could do.
6 years ago, 8 years ago, you take a look at the 6th Congressional District, and it was just Fred Upton all day, and the Democrat never got within a 10% margin of error. Now all of a sudden we're talking about this as possibly the best Democratic pickup opportunity for 2020. It seems like the big switch is happening in Kalamazoo County. It's trending Democrat in a very hard and fast way. Why is that? What's going on in Kalamazoo County?
Well, we're seeing that folks in Kalamazoo are excited about treating people fairly, about paying people well for a good day of work, for, you know, protecting the environment, standing up for healthcare, a lot of Democratic values, making sure that we are building a diverse and welcoming community is really resonating with a lot of voters, you know, all across the 6th Congressional District. You know, we're really excited that we've been able to work hard in those districts. You know, I look at what those results started to look like for turnout and engagement, you know, when I first started running for state representative, you know, because of the conversations and work that's happening. Yeah, I was excited that we were the top vote getter on the Democratic side of the ticket in my district. I think this is part of a broader change that's happening across the country, where folks are also seeing that our votes do matter. Showing up matters. And if you choose not to vote, you're letting someone else make a choice for you. They're seeing a changing Republican Party that maybe doesn't reflect their values like they used to. The number of people I talk to who say that they used to be Republican, but that party moved away from them. And then they see folks who are, you know, trying to come up with real solutions, not this party of no, not the, we have to think so small, where people just say we can't do things. Where I think we're seeing people excited to rise up to the moment that we're in and participate. And we're seeing it across the district. Kalamazoo County, I think, moved in a big way. We saw that in the last election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we're actually seeing, I think, voters all across Southwest Michigan get more involved. And I think the 2018 results were reflective of that.
But the Democratic Party has had its own challenges over the years. You talk about a diverse party. In part, that's been the Democratic Party's problem. Too much diversity. Progressives versus moderates, unions versus non-union. How do you hold the party together? And especially when you've got a race coming up for president, you've got 24 different candidates in that race.
I know, with the 24 Democrats that are running, I have to keep announcing I'm not running for president. But you know, it's part of our diversity is our strength. And what I'm excited about is you're seeing so many different people coming to the tables with solutions. One of the key differences then that we have debunked this fiction that there is no difference between the political parties. I don't know how many times I used to hear that. It doesn't matter who you vote for, right? They're all the same. And that's just not true. And, you know, I always tell the story from my own personal life, right? As, you know, I watch as an openly gay man how the Democratic Party, still not perfect, but it has come such a long way. And I watch so many of my Republican colleagues in the Republican Party try to dig in their heels. And there is a generational moment where now we can see that the parties are different. And who you vote for has real consequence on people's lives. And so I think that's part of this overall piece. You know, we are going to have disagreements within the Democratic Party. We always have. We always will. I don't think someone needs to be 100% in agreement to call themselves a Democrat, right? Because that doesn't make sense either. But I do think that we are seeing more support and coalescing energy around this idea that vision that the Democrats have for moving forward of equal justice under law, of more opportunity for more people, making sure that your zip code is not going to determine your life outcomes. All these sort of pieces is bringing us together in a way that it could define a political moment for the next generation.
Give me three Democratic presidential hopefuls you're excited about.
Sure, I'm excited about all 24 of them.
No, I mean, sure.
No, you know, and I will say very publicly, I'm taking one of those, like, if you would like to come visit Southwest Michigan, come visit. And I'm happy to give you a tour. We want more people here. I don't think there's going to be a single one of the Democratic presidential candidates that are going to take Michigan for granted in 2020. You know, but I think it's interesting. We're seeing some conversation and energy around the Warren-Bernie sort of group. And I think that's interesting. You know, I mean, obviously we've got our neighbor to the south, Pete Buttigieg, you know, I think is really changing some of the conversations around values in the party. I'm looking at people like Senator Harris, the way that she's approaching problems, the way that she's holding folks accountable in Congress, I think has inspired a lot of folks in this race. So I think, you know, as you start looking, and then it goes on, right? Like, you know, everything from Andrew Yang to Cory Booker to, you know, people are interested and are engaged. And the other thing I'll just notice, I think people and supporters are doing a pretty good job about lifting up what they like about their candidates, as opposed to trying to tear other candidates down. And I hope that trend continues.
You're seeing the most excitement around whom?
I'm not trying to be cagey here, actually. Like, it just depends on who I'm talking to. You know, I still see a ton of people who are excited about Bernie Sanders and remember the energy from 2016. I see a ton of people who are given, particularly, I think, Elizabeth Warren, a new look. And I think that's reflective in also her rise in the polls recently. I know a ton of LGBT folks who are so excited about Mayor Pete because he is breaking a ceiling right now where who you are or who you love should not determine your political future. But oftentimes it's still part of the conversation. I do see, the other one is I see a lot of energy around Harris in my neck of the woods. Folks who are, you know, excited to see a strong woman at the top of the ticket, a woman of color who's, you know, sort of bridging conversations in a really important way. I mean, the other piece is we're going to have our first debate. By the time we hear this, we'll have done our first debate. This is something that's going to keep changing day in and day out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that the field will start to shake out after we get through the first couple debates.
John Hundley, state representative from Kalamazoo and 6th Congressional District candidate. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Always a pleasure to be here.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the guys here for coming and joining us. And John, I guess it doesn't really matter whether we tape on Monday morning or we tape on an 87-degree afternoon on Friday.
The beautiful sound of summer, those whining mowers in the background.
Why?
It's not my guy.
I know it's not your guy, but
I've almost just kind of thought it comical now. It's as if we don't have a mower, in the dull roar in the background, I'm going to feel like something's wrong.
How warm that sound would make you feel if it were January.
Think of how warm that guy's got to be mowing the lawn in an 87-degree afternoon.
Yep.
All right, thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care. You can't